If the Bible's true, and I sure believe it is, then you got to be insane to not be a Christian once light shines on you. Not everybody does God give the opportunity. Only you lucky ones have God's choice marking you out and the capacity to understand, to hear and understand and see and perceive. And to those that have seen the light, you've got to be insane. We, for some weeks out of Deuteronomy, have been characterizing the polarization of choice. Slave to God, Deuteronomy 28, or slave to your enemies. Nobody wants to be a slave until the choice is clearly seen. You're a slave anyway. Your choice is which one for your master. Jesus said, I put before you two ways, the way of life, the way of death. Those are the only two. Very few people act like they believe any of that. I submit that even in this congregation, much of the past week, to keep a short zone, has been spent without those choices hanging very low in your range of vision or clear to be seen. We hear it on Sunday, occasionally tune in, but essentially remain unchanged. Then we come the next Sunday and hear it again. And after a while we get sort of immune to it. We put on spiritual ears and nod our head and say, yes, that's true. But we keep serving our enemies. We keep on the way of death. If you really believe what's been taught here from God's Word, you'd be scared spitless. Now, my job, I said when I came here, and I've said it several times, is to bring comfort to the sinners and discomfort to the saints. Comfort to the sinners that you got a chance. And then when you take the chance, keep you discomforted all the way home. I read from G. Campbell Morgan. Nothing's worse than that state of mind that is so secure, you think it's all been done, you've gone through some motion, and you don't have to worry about your salvation anymore. Paul says we're to work out our salvation. The Greek words are cognates for our words, fear and trauma, phobias and trauma. It ought to make us as one with a phobia. It ought to keep us in a perpetual state of trauma. I don't see much of that in Christianity. Nobody's working out their salvation with fear and trembling or phobias and traumas. Well, you've been telling me that grace, unmerited favor, is our portion. All it takes is trust. Right. What's trust? Running like hell to the shelter of a rock. Running like hell to the sheltering wings of a mother bird. You ever seen little birds scurry to little chicks to get under the mother hen's wings? That's what faith is. I'm going to scare you some more. And then comfort you. Psalm 49. I'm going to actually use text today. I looked around here, it scared me. I thought that was sperm. Amazing how one subject will always bring you to attention. Talk about eternal life and you go to sleep. Use the word sperm even if you didn't hear the whole sentence. You're suddenly wide awake. I'm actually going to use a couple of texts today. Psalm 49, verse 14. And the last book of the Bible, Revelation 7, verse 17. They're not translated properly. That shouldn't shock you too much. This afternoon, God willing, as I do a live festival, I'm going to give you another doc note from a book that you can't obtain anywhere. But Tischendorf, the finder of the Codex Sinaiticus, one of the three and one of the two earliest complete Bibles in existence, 4th century, 320 to 340 A.D., he did a New Testament in which he worked out a very simple code using simple formulas, B for Vaticanus, the other 4th century manuscript, S for Sinaiticus, the one he found at St. Catherine's Monastery, 4th century, and A for Alexandrinus in the British Museum, 5th century. None of the three available when the King James was translated. To the translators, the Vaticanus had been found, but it wasn't available to them. And he has a little code as he publishes this New Testament down in the bottom. For each verse, he has the code showing where S or V or A, leave out a word or add a word or change a word, so that you can compare your New Testament with what these oldest manuscripts said or didn't say by comparison, knowing that the King James was utilizing much later manuscripts down the genetic tree of translations. I'm going to give that away as a doc note today on the first chapter of Romans, as hopefully I'll, in this year, get into Romans verse by verse. But it shouldn't shock you, with all the manuscripts we have, that I say King James is not translated accurately. It reads, well, let's go up a little bit. they that trust, verse 6, in their wealth, boast themselves in the multitude of their riches. Their inward thought, verse 11, is that their houses shall continue forever, and their dwelling places to all generations. They call their lands after their own names. Somebody pretty comfortable down here. They think they're going to go on, get better, leave it all to their kids. Hear this, all you people, verse 1. Give ear, all ye inhabitants of the world, both low and high, rich and poor, together. This is their way, verse 13. And now the text, verse 14. Like sheep, they are laid in the grave. Death shall feed on them. Revelation 17:17. The saints of God, suffering tribulation on this earth as their master did. 17th verse. Well, let's go to the 15th. Therefore are they before the throne of God and serve Him, slavery, day and night. 17th verse. For the Lamb which is in the midst of the throne shall feed them. Neither one of those translations say what the original says. Here's the original. Like sheep, those comfortable ones down here, like sheep, they are thrust down, pushed into the grave. Death shall be their shepherd. Death shall be their shepherd. Two shepherds, the subject today. Two masters, two lifestyles, slave of God, two shepherds. And you don't get to choose, dumb sheep that we are, not to have a shepherd. Your choice is who will be your shepherd. These comfortable ones. Let's read it again. Hear this, all ye people. Give ear, all ye inhabitants of the world. Do you fit into that category? All ye people, all ye inhabitants, both low and high, rich and poor, together. My mouth shall speak of wisdom, and the meditation of my heart shall be of understanding. They that trust in their wealth and boast themselves in the multitude of their riches. You know, I'm not at all convinced that all of you, I look around and see some here every Sunday, and that gives me hope that some understand what God is given you as an opportunity. Never in the history of mankind has one voice been able to proclaim every hour of every day on every square inch of the globe God's word of light these choices everywhere. It never happened. Paul would come out of the grave for this chance. Paul, who said that it's much better for him to go when he was writing the Philippians, but it's needful for you, he said to them, that I stay, longing to be absent from the body and present with the Lord, he would leave the Lord's presence. And the glories of heaven, which he anticipated having been caught up to the third heavens with more than one, he'd come back to participate in what this church and this ministry has been honored to do. And yet some of you, that quickly, for a better economic opportunity, a job, a business opportunity, a woman or a man, I mean, they're a dime a dozen. Some of you act like that. Well, I know, I've been there, I thought that once. Oh, if I don't get this one, there'll never be another. They're like streetcars. Some of you could learn from your pastor. I have a sign over the door to my bar that says, I'll never cry over a woman again. I'll just yell next. A job? Oh, if I don't take this opportunity, God in all of His powers, the Lord of hosts, cannot find another one for me. And in a New York minute, you'll leave a place in this ministry, not deeming, like that profane person Esau, not discerning the true nature of spiritual things. There are some that have worked for me. I'm tough. I'm also the easiest man in the world to work for, because it all boils down to attitude. You can make any kind of mistake. It's an honest mistake. Face it. And I see the light of understanding in your eyes. We don't even address it anymore. Tomorrow I'll probably forget what you did. You start going into that self-protective, self-preservation, ego-serving freeze, and I become a living volcanic blowtorch. Because I can't just be your boss, I'm your pastor. And I can't see you sell your soul out to your self-serving ego. And I got to be, I went around the congregation, I sort of lowered the boom a few weeks ago and said, those that aren't right with the pastor, you're out of here. And I've gotten some apologies from ex-employees, and that's fine. Be honest enough to face the fact you messed up. And you need a little tender, loving self-care. Some self-stroking. I have other words for that. You have to, you know, lick your wound for a while. Well, as long as you're honest, face up to your failure and gather yourself for getting up pointed the right direction, it's okay with me. You can sit in here and learn. I want you to go to heaven. But, you know, one left not too long ago, and I gave him another chance. I saw him with a nice smile the other day. I said, you know, You never grew a spiritual centimeter out of touch with my blowtorch. You're still where you were. Now, there's people all over this congregation. You absorb the teaching. And you're following God in your life and learning, and God's training you. Then there's that core of people that come into the staff as I set out to change things about a year ago. And I can tell you, don't applaud because the job's not finished. But I can tell you, I'm making progress. I have a better staff today than I had a year ago. Saying that will probably make them all go nuts. But some of them are getting a lot better because they're facing with me their besetting sins. And they have come to a conclusion that having been picked by God, through me, led by Him to choose you, it's a life and death matter. It isn't something you just, well, I want to try this. I had one not too long ago. I get stacks of paper of him saying what a jerk he was and various kinds of street language. Yeah, he really is. But what's worse, he insults me by him thinking that I'm a jerk like him, that his words will reach me. He flunked because he decided when he got on the job that he didn't feel as happy as he used to feel. Didn't I say a few minutes ago, my job is to make the saints discomforted? How anybody could ever get so far along in this ministry to apply for a job with me, and you're going to judge everything but your feelings? Only if you are in love with pain. Is that an adequate criteria? Well, I didn't feel as good on the job. Well, I guess not. You had a loving, adoring wife. You'd conned into her position. And kids who were totally dependent upon you, and suddenly you're on the firing line. I wonder how many people in the battlefield, in a hot battle somewhere, say to the staff sergeant that's over them, "Sir, I don't feel right in this foxhole. Can I go home?" You shoot kinds like that in the butt while they're running away. So if this jerk's listening, find the brain and mix courage in and recognize you're a two-bit loser. God doesn't want you. How could you say that? The Bible's full of it. I believe the Bible. Without faith, it's impossible to please God. And courage is 90% of faith. There ain't no quitters, runners. Look what it cost Peter to run. Why didn't Jesus say, "You know, Peter, if I had been where you were that night, I probably would have acted the same way. I mean, I know I hurt your feelings and put that guy's ear back on, and I know you were trying, you know. It takes a lot of skill to hit an ear and not hit something else." Manipulators. I don't know how to manipulate. And I'll bet in there, you didn't tell the other disciples, but I really bet you didn't get impatient because I was late. I really want to believe, and I think it's probably true, that you were out there and you used that argument to get the rest of them to help you because you wanted to catch a fish so you'd have a fish to fry for me when I got here. Now, I hope you've learned a lesson. I caught more fish on dry ground than you did on the water, but I understand what you were trying to do. He said, "Look, jerkhead, I have put up with you, and I've shown mercy, and I sent a special message, after the resurrection. I've listened to you brag. You never can get things right. I want to wash your feet. And you say, no. And then when I tell you you can't go to heaven if I don't, you say, wash me all over. And I say, somebody's going to deny me. You can't say, no, I won't. You have to say, I'll die before I do it. And you are denying, and cursing, and dissimulating, and fleeing. And I still, at the resurrection, sent you a special message saying, go tell my disciples and Peter that I'll see you at Galilee. And when I get here, you dumb, stupid jerk, you're out there fishing. And then you try to compensate for it by jumping out of the boat in the water and swimming to me. You tried walking on water once and sunk. You didn't even try this time. Now I'm telling you, you dumb loony, with your version of Christianity, you have done what you wanted to do up till now, but from now on, another's going to bind you, seize you and bind you, and lead you to death. Well, what about John? Well, up your whatchamacallit with a truck running sideways, if John lives till I come again, that's none of your damn business. You're going to go through what I just told you. That ain't very sweet treatment, is it? And I can tell you, I have not really added too much to the scene. I just put it in modern language. In other words, I'm sick of you, Peter. And D-Day has arrived. Now, either get your ass out there in the boat and don't ever come around me again, or understand where you're going. You are not your own. You belong to another, and that other, which is me, is taking you and leading you to death. God did not choose you, if you even remember, ex lexito, the word in Ephesians concerning that wonderful happening of God choosing us before the worlds were formed. He chose us, middle voice, for himself. Not for you, for him. He chose you for himself. That ain't a popular message today. God's supposed to be looking out for us. God exists for us. I'll only serve a God that finally comes to his senses and understands who the boss is. Sorry. That ain't the way it's laid out. He's the boss. He works with us as individuals. He may be a John. He chooses a different thing for us. But this church, out of all the churches in the 2,000-year history since it was bought and paid for and delivered from this world and set on a highway or life path to eternity to be God's show-off to the eons of time, this church selected to carry the light to the whole world. Not our doing. We're still struggling, trying to get Secret Six totally completed in Anguilla. Oh, we've got the short wave. We've got the power up on 690. We've moved 99.5 there to become an FM from the island. We're still with some big boxes sitting across from King's House 1 with those giant curtain antennas that we purchased from Far East Broadcasting that were purchased and designed to sit and project the signal with equal power the other way to Europe. That's what started this. We will keep moving forward. But it's sort of an object lesson. We, in faith, moved in our strength through an open door, asking God's help and your sacrifice. And while we were doing and still doing that, God took us, in response to that faith move, around the world. God's doing. These musicians are a necessary part. I'm hard on them, because I know what musicians can be in the Church of God. But they're a necessary part of this ministry. Doesn't matter whether you like them or not, they help get me ready for a message. You sitting in front of me are essential parts of the message that goes out. Oh, I can preach to an empty building. But it's not the same. And if, as pastor, I have no heartfelt identity with the sheep of this congregation and the reality of breached commitments, empty seats wouldn't even bother me. The only reason the red seats bother me is it reflects on an attitude of people that have been given a chance to be here at the heart where the live message goes out. People who have made commitments and broke them. Just like when we're live on festival, if I ask for phone calls and they don't come, it reflects breached commitments and spiritual state of the congregation. I'm not an unconscious pastor. I stand one day in eternity before the chief shepherd as under shepherd and give account for this congregation. I have to walk the tightrope between encouraging, disciplining, correcting, and keeping the sheep of this pasture on the track. And the track's very clear. We have been selected to take this message out. That's your responsibility and mine. Therefore, this servitude is not just in a vacuum. In addition to your own individual responsibilities, you are debtor to God for this choice, and at least 10% of your time and your money belongs in this fold. If you move to a higher level, to where you're on staff, now we're talking much larger percentages of commitment and time, and a much heavier test and a greater attack from Satan, and the necessity that you learn the rules of spiritual warfare at an even higher level. So all of these messages slice across the continuum of these different levels within the congregation, including those that are just coming in as strangers, invitees, for the very first time being exposed, carrying all the baggage of their traditional views of what a church should be. Something that belongs to them and serves them, rather than something that belongs to God and serves Him. Well, the choice is clear. You comfortable ones, like sheep, they are thrust down in the grave. Death shall feed on them is not the translation. Death shall be your shepherd. How many of you remember in Ephesians where God finds us? dead in trespasses, that's sins we know about, dead in trespasses and sins, the state of being, out of God's presence, out of God's knowledge, out of God's viewpoint, out of God's ways, out of His standard. Dead. You say, I'm not dead. I wasn't dead. Yes, you are. Because death, now we take it to another level, is your shepherd. Death is shepherding. And not like a shepherd who leads, but one who pushes. The picture is still dumb sheep under the control of something else. Ah! Ah! My dad, one of these days I'll play his vision again in the coma with rheumatic fever. We thought he was gone. Some of you here heard him tell the vision. First, he felt himself lifting out of his body. I know the scene engraved in my mind as a boy. I still remember being waked up in the middle of the night when rheumatic fever first hit him. And my mother saying, what's wrong, Ted? And I'm waked up running the living room and Dad's dragging around holding on the back of kitchen-style chairs and almost screaming with the pain in his legs, and I can't support myself with my legs anymore. 6'2", 180 pounds, picture of health. From that, the disease went through his body, eventually hit him in the back of the neck. He went into a coma. Down to 125 pounds. We thought Dad was gone. I remember the night when he was, after a long period in the coma, laying there, the pastor was praying on one side. My mother was crying. She'd given birth to twins during the sickness. First the little girl died, then the little boy died. We were poverty-stricken. Friends brought in food. There was no insurance. Dad's, we thought, dead, gonna die quickly. His side of the story is, he felt himself coming out of his body. The roof was no more, and he looks down and sees the room. And as he tells the story, he looks around up and sees what looks like a great balcony up in the clouds. And people happy and waving him on up. And he saw his mother there. And in that experience, I can't tell it his dad did, he said, Lord, I'm ready to go, but I hate to leave my wife and my boy. He then felt himself as though carried or transported, and the scene of heaven's balcony disappeared, and he saw a vast Broadway, and people happy, joyous, dancing, having a wonderful time, sort of an incline in this Broadway of people just having the most wonderful time. And he's carried along in this vision, dream, reality, or whatever it was. And he comes down this Broadway to a place where on the other side's darkness and chained. On each side are vicious, evil-looking demons who are reaching up and grabbing these people at the bottom of this Broadway and hurling them into the darkness. He heard screams and cries of agony, wails. And he said he thought he would lose his mind, and he cried out to the Lord, "Lord, take me away from this place." Then the scene changed. And he's well and healthy, walking up a narrow path with a Bible under his arm. Now, Dad had been converted in a little church in Oroville. Had felt a desire to go into the ministry, but never having finished high school, he felt he was untrained and inadequate, didn't have the qualifications. So he resisted, served as a deacon in the church that he later would come to pastor many years later. And he sees himself well, healthy, Bible under his arm, walking up this narrow path. And he hears himself say, "Lord, what does this mean?" And he hears a voice say, "Preach my word, I'll heal you." And with that, having ascended in his spirit to the wonder of it, on the other side of the scene, we saw this happen. He sits up in bed, points his finger at my mother, and says, "I'll be preaching in 6 months." And he was. That's why I play this tape of my dad leading the service the last Sunday before he died at 86 on the subsequent Saturday. So you can see how vital and well he was. After 30 years, he evangelized, pastored in small towns of Live Oak and Gridley, in each case building the largest church in the city, and then returned to the church that he had been converted in, and ultimately to found Westcott Christian Center in 1963. But for 30 years, when he returned to Oroville, he pastored, then retired, came down here, and was my associate. I said, "Dad, you're not going to retire. The promise is, preach my word, I'll heal you." And I always felt as his son, I was an agent to help keep him alive. The doctors all died. He prophesied major heart problems because rheumatic fever had gone above the waist. My dad is a testimony still when I play him on that tape, as God kept him to his 86th year, vital, healthy, well, keeping his promise. And when he left, it was as the psalmist prophesies concerning the saints and death. They don't have to suffer. God just takes their breath away. That which he breathed into Adam, he takes back. My dad is an illustration in that vision of that Broadway of these comfortable ones who are being shepherded. Death shepherds them. You are sheep, and I am sheep, and there are two shepherds that will rule us. Death shepherds us, gives us what we want here as a means of keeping us from following the other shepherd. Out of all the people of this earth, in this generation, Jesus, who said, "My sheep know my voice," got the message to you. And you have the responsibility to follow your shepherd, either the shepherd of life, or death will be your shepherd. Let's go to the way it ends for those that have the right shepherd. And I've been walking this tightrope, slavery, worship, the choice is not so bad when you understand the nature of the master. Now again, the choice, will death shepherd you down that Broadway my dad saw? Ultimately, to be thrust down into the grave. Grave hardly says it. The Old Testament word is closer to that darkness my father saw, apart and away from God forever, ever, death eternal. Or those who come out of great tribulation, washed their robes, verse 14, Revelation 7, and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. Figurative language. Life resides in the blood, the life of the soul, Leviticus 17, which is why blood is so much a part of the Old Testament, expunging of sin, for death, for life, for sin. They all mix together. For sin comes death, life is poured out when blood is poured out, and the Old Testament sacrifices have the lesson built into them that God is providing, by, to use technological and theological terms, vicarious sacrifice. He's going to take the blood of another, the outpoured life of another, in our place, that we might walk away not having paid for our sins the just due, which is death. The cry of the human soul is the same as the New Testament utterance. Blood of animals and goats, that which is lesser, cannot suffice as a life in the place of mine and yours. Therefore, the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world, God's failsafe for Adam's sin and ours, steps forward, leaves the throne of glory, fulfills the requirement of the perfect sacrifice, and in the flesh masters sin, and then, without fault, able to return as the perfect servant to the place that he had, chooses for our sake to offer himself. And that outpouring of his blood paid the penalty for the sins of the whole world. And we stand white before God by faith, accepting the washing of the blood of the Lamb. Therefore, our destiny before the throne of God, and serve him day and night in his temple, and he that sitteth on the throne shall dwell among them. They shall hunger no more, versus that state of constant hunger in Deuteronomy 28 that we've been preaching about. They shall hunger no more, neither thirst any more, neither shall the sun light on them nor any heat. For the Lamb which is in the midst of the throne shall feed them, literally. For the Lamb which is in the midst of the throne shall be their shepherd. Sort of an ironic twist. He who became sheep like us, clothed in the likeness of sinning flesh, fighting off every single urge and resistance to God's claim, knowing that he had been sent to die, but clothed with all the self-preservation instincts of this garment of flesh he put on. He knew no sin. And now, as our shepherd, he was also a lamb. Now, as our shepherd, as the book of Hebrews says, we do not have a high priest that cannot be touched with our infirmities and needs. This is that tightrope between comfort and discomfort. He knows our frame. He sat where we sat. He knows the power of Satan to tempt. He knows the agony of the struggle. He is not one that can't be touched with our infirmities because he took our infirmities. Nevertheless, he's still the shepherd now, a better shepherd, if I could use such terms in relationship to the one who was the voice of eternity and creation, But he's a better shepherd now, because he knows where we sit, how we are, what the pressure is that's on us. He knows the incapacities. That's why he's willing to be the capacitator. But it still involves that decision made. He will be my shepherd. And the Lamb which is in the midst of the throne shall be their shepherd, and shall lead them unto living fountains of water. And I've been talking about it not being such a bad deal. And God shall wipe away all tears from their eyes. Tears for the moment. Joy in the morning. Tribulation's here. Hunger no more, thirst no more. Led to living fountains of water, and God shall wipe away all tears from their eyes. That's the choice, folks. And it isn't made in some magnificent epiphany of spiritual thunderings, the day-to-day little choices. Am I going to follow the shepherd who leads? And the choice not to follow the shepherd who leads is to be corralled and ushered by that other shepherd, death. The narrow path, God's way, the broad way to death. I don't know why God has kept me on this subject for so long. Two choices. Slave to God, slave to enemies. Two ways, life, death. Two shepherds. Death, pushing us down the easy road, or the Lamb that gave himself for us and rose to lead us and wants to lead you all the way home. That's your choice, and that's my message. I often think, as I marvel at God taking this voice around the world, not only did the choice begin before the world was formed, God was still acting in healing my dad, in sickness and tragedy overriding his own feelings of inadequacy, bringing him up that path of preach my word. Had he not gone through that and followed that path, I'm quite sure my path would have been different. I wouldn't have had the foundation in faith and background that prepared me for this hour of God's choosing. Every one of you can see God's hand in your life, and some of you are coming to the intelligence spiritually of knowing that God was working even when you didn't know He was working. You are not an accident, and it's not an accident that you are here and part of this ministry. Take that responsibility and privilege with the dignity that it deserves. Don't treat it cheaply. Your trip, you that are sitting home today, hundreds of you know you should be here in the cathedral today, holding down your space, like the Colossians to whom Paul wrote, soldiers in their position. Some of you need to renew your commitments as voices of faith. And quit being like the children of Israel who forgot why they were returned to Jerusalem in the dust and mundaneness of lifting rocks and cutting them for the walls and for the temple. They forgot that they were uniquely chosen to build the house into which Messiah would come in His first coming. To be part of God's workmanship is the highest privilege you'll ever have on this earth. Don't treat it cheaply. We'll be live this afternoon on festival. If you're one of the voices of faith that's supposed to be there, don't let God down. It's offering time. The song is Joy Comes in the Morning.